If you attend college looking for vocational training, you may end up with a degree, a certificate, or maybe a special badge in empathy.
Were they even aware that they're empathetic or not?
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation about academic digital badges. We'll also hear about reports and programs focusing on preventing gun violence in schools and spend an academic minute with a mass shooting database. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. You know what people most look for when they call an electrician? Empathy. That's just one of the 8 digital academic badges you can earn at Central New Mexico Community College. Here to talk about these market-driven badges is Denise Ojeda, a licensed journeyman electrician and full-time faculty member at the college. Before we spoke about the badges, however, we talked about women in her field.
I don't know if you know this, but women make up all of electricians in the United States only 2%. So that's just a side note.
Are you working to change that?
I'm working on projects at our college about equity and diversity. And part of it is like reinventing Rosie. It's like if we did it in the 40s, why aren't we doing it now to fill these skills gap?
And part of what you're doing involves what you're calling now is badges. What are those?
Digital badges, what it is they're assignments, they're assessments, reading, videos, and then practice assignments based on professional skills that have been identified as 21st century skills or professionalism. Our industry, at least in New Mexico, and actually it's around the country, are saying that people are missing professional skills. People skills, human skills, that they have all the technical skills, but they can't keep their jobs because they just can't get along or act appropriately.
What are some of the skills we're talking about?
Well, number one on the hit parade right now is empathy, the ability to disengage and understand what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, to respect, resilience, oral communications, collaborative initiative. Those are a few of the 8 that we're doing at my college.
How do you teach empathy?
That's what I thought as well. There's videos. They're broken up into 3 categories. You get a video, and then they have some readings that go with the video. So if we're talking about the first video is a walk in my shoes, and it's just no words. It's just watching people through a hospital. And then commenting on that, did you notice this? Articles on emotional intelligence. And then finally, a practice assessment on interviewing somebody or a made-up scenario so that they react to, and you observe them try these reactions, and then a final assessment. And that gauges it, did they learn what was taught in the module? And actually, it's not so much on the grading of it, but it's watching them go through the process. From where the beginning, were they even aware that they're empathetic or not, or what their degree is? There's tests that they take online on these assessments. All I ask is to see that they took them. I don't necessarily want to see their scores. If they want to self-identify, that's another thing. It's mostly about their awareness and seeing that there may be a deficit, and then what they're doing to achieve or self-correct. And part of that, as you're going along, it's like as they're learning how things go, is that watching their growth and their journey getting to that final assessment.
You told a very interesting story in a little talk where just as an electrician had to come into your classroom, and it was an interesting experience.
Yes, we had a power issue, ironically enough, and something wasn't working. It was a prolonged problem, and I thought, teachable moment, we all have meters, and so my class tested it. And they finally got an electrician there, and he was actually his his demeanor was less than gracious, and he inferred that, you know, I'm a licensed electrician, you can't tell me what to do. And I thought I was giving him the opportunity for a teachable moment, and then part of me kind of slept into construction mode, and so it was kind of not shouting, but it was a tense environment. When I walked away from the class, we were both kind of heated by the discussion. I went into my next class with the same group of students and said, okay, how do we do this? How could I have done this better? Total honesty. And they were saying, hey, you should have pinched him in the nose. I'm like, no, that's not an option. How could I have done? And it took a while for them to get away because they were angry too about how he was treating me. And again, it's like, but what can we do when it comes to real life? You're going to have to be resilient. You're going to have to react to stress. Things aren't always going to be perfect. So in those moments, that's when these skills are really critical. What could I have done better?
Well, it really did turn into a teachable moment.
It did. After I calmed down, yeah, it did. But again, it was like, it just reinforces you have to model the behavior, you have to practice the behavior. And even at my age, which I'm older than most of my students, have gone through trainings and try my best to be this better human being. When come to tasks, you really have to practice and admit when you fail. And out of those failures come great lessons. So at least they got to see me kind of fall on my face a little bit, but yet recover and say, yeah, in the future, give me some guidance on how I could have handled myself better, and seeing what their feedback was.
Out in the business world, out in the job market, how do these badges help?
We have a partnership with, again, part of what I do is I'm the liaison between industry and the college. And so I meet with industry often, and that we identified a small group of contractors that came to the trainings and who identified as empathy as the number one badge that they want. And the agreement was if our students get these badges, that what they'll do is grant them a first interview. No guarantee on a job, but a first interview. And for some of these contractors are really large, that's a huge, you know, it's not going to go into the circular file. It's like, oh, they'll stand out for that first interview. It's up for them to get the job, but at least they have a step in. And then, again, a tracking mechanism to see how successful this is or not.
Do you see this program expanding in the future to include either more badges or more schools?
Well, that's what we're doing now. We started with a really small test project with our career technical, the programs that I oversee. And now this year they're expanding it to the rest of the college. So liberal arts, STEM fields, health and wellness, our entire college, there's a call out for training instructors to teach these badges and to embed them in their coursework. This doesn't cost anything. I mean, to be a better human being, the cost is minimal. It's reflecting and rethinking how you teach in the classroom. It's modeling those behaviors that industry wants to see, that you want to see, that I want to feel when I have any interaction with another person. It's if you teach it in a thoughtful approach and adjust your outcomes to meet these demands, it's almost seamless. And it's, you know, you're giving them permission and giving myself permission for 15 weeks to try harder and be better on school and lessons that you assume you learned as a child. There was a question earlier saying, hey, how do we do this? You should have learned this as a four-year-old. And my contention is, in my classroom, my students range from 16 to 60, different learning styles, experience. The thing is, it's not happening. And it doesn't matter where it started or how it ends, but it's like, while we have them in the classrooms, we can engage them in a thoughtful approach to have a more holistic student. Whatever they want to be, if they want to be a doctor, lawyer, electrician, plumber, it doesn't matter. We all can do better.
Denise Ojeda is a licensed journeyman electrician and full-time faculty member at Central New Mexico Community College in Albuquerque. We spoke at the Education Writers Association's seminar on higher education at the University of Michigan last month. Okay, now let's talk about school safety. In New York State, the Westchester County School Safety Commission has released its recommendations in a report aimed at preventing, planning for, and responding to school violence. The best of our knowledge is Allison Dunn spoke with Westchester County District Attorney Anthony Scarpino, who co-chairs the county's School Safety Commission.
Scarpino says the idea of forming a school safety commission emerged from his office. The Democrat co-chairs the commission with Westchester County Executive George Latimer. the commission formed at the start of last school year.
Well, it was prompted, of course, by what's been happening across the country, Sandy Hook, Columbine. Sandy Hook, of course, was closest to home. But it was something that, in my discussions with my staff, it kept me up at night. I wanted to be sure that if something ever occurred here in Westchester County, that we had done whatever we could to prepare the schools and the community to address it and react to it. So by creating this commission, the goal was to get a report that would level the playing field, that every individual school district would have a standardized program available.
So let's get to the report.
Well, it's 40 pages. The goal is to try to enhance the quality of the school atmosphere, as well as the communications within the school and without the school with law enforcement and mental health professionals. That's a major part of it, trying to address the issues that the students have within the schools, trying to ensure that there's a line of communications within the schools to make a determination and be aware of if something unfortunate appears to be coming, an individual is in crisis. That is part, it's a major part of it, is the increase in the quality of the communications. And then outside, a decision to be made as to when you contact law enforcement and how law enforcement prepares to react to any issue that does occur. The goal is to be aware of potential problems and create a plan that involves intervention.
Did you look to any other areas of either the state or the country in developing these?
Yes, we did. This is very much data-based. We reached out to numerous locations. We studied the incidents that occurred at other places like Columbine, and we did a lot of research in regards to it. You know, Westchester's a pretty unique place. We have 400 schools that we have to address. So we wanted to make sure also that law enforcement and our capabilities of emergency response understood where they would go, how they would go, having access to blueprints, having steady annual reviews of emergency response plans and conducting annual emergency crisis response training and drills, establishing a law enforcement point of contact for the school. That is the second part of the program. One has to do with threat prevention, and the other has to do with crisis management and law enforcement. The other part of it is the law enforcement agencies are going to be broaching with the school districts, trying to develop their part of it, developing a person of contact, working with them to do, crisis response training and drills. And, this will help push any school district that was not so inclined to participate in it. But I have to feel, that all the school districts are all very concerned about the safety of their students and their teachers. That's the main takeaway of the report and this commission. The safety of our children, our students, and our teachers is the most important thing to us. We're collaborating with all the stakeholders to try to introduce this blueprint, and we're hopeful that the school districts will follow it.
And are you hopeful that there'd be a timeline for which they'd follow it?
Well, the report has been issued, and the goal is for these steps to be taken, that the school districts should review this report and then create, one contact, one called, to law enforcement and start building their relationships with the local law enforcement in their area if they haven't already done so, create their own threat assessment team. Because the schools will be the first people to recognize a person in crisis, and then the goal is for them to have created a threat assessment team that's trained to evaluate the nature of the crisis the individual is having and make a determination whether it is something that needs law enforcement intervention or whether it's not at the crisis level where that's necessary and it can be handled internally within the school, providing the student with the assistance they need.
He says the commission will continue to meet and see if any modifications or additional proposals are needed. Around the time Westchester's Safer Schools report came out, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo launched a statewide education campaign on New York's new red flag law. The law establishes a civil procedure that allows a concerned family member, school official, or member of law enforcement to obtain a court order, known as an extreme risk protection order, to remove and keep guns away from individuals who pose a serious risk of harm to themselves or others. The law became effective August 24th. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Allison Dunn.
still to come, a parent of a Sandy Hook shooting victim is speaking out about a promise he made after the tragedy. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. At the time of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School mass shooting, Mark Barden's son Daniel was 7 years old. Daniel lost his life in that shooting. Since then, Mark Barden has tried to help prevent other parents from experiencing the same pain and loss. Barden recently traveled to North Adams, Massachusetts, along with the state's Attorney General, Maura Healey, to speak to students about Sandy Hook Promise, the nonprofit that Barden co-founded in 2013. It offers violence prevention and mental health training programs. Barden spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Josh Landes about the nonprofit's collaboration with the Attorney General, as well as what it's like to speak with students about what they experience in the school system.
We've been working with the Attorney General's office, with Maura Healey and her team, in a partnership with the Stop School Violence Act, which is a funding bill which allows schools, states, districts to train in evidence-based violence prevention programming like what we do at Sandy Hook Promise. It allows us to offset our costs to train and implement these programs in schools so that we can continue to offer them for free. Sandy Hook Promise operates under the mantra that school violence, all violence, gun violence is preventable when you know the signs, and that's what we do at Sandy Hook Promise. We train students how to recognize warning signs of at-risk behavior that could be a possible indicator to somebody thinking about hurting themselves or hurting somebody else, and connect that individual with the help that they need before it becomes something more serious.
So in the wake of an unimaginable tragedy like the country experienced with Sandy Hook, what is it like to go out and actually talk with students about this issue, you know, on a daily basis?
The tragedy at Sandy Hook has shaken me to the core. I lost my 7-year-old son, Daniel, in that shooting, and has changed me as a person and sent me off on this mission literally to prevent this pain from visiting other families. And that's exactly what we do. So while it's very difficult and very challenging, it's too important to not do this work. I feel there's so much value in empowering students with our programs that we know will save lives and is already doing so. So knowing that, and knowing that we have these profound tools at our fingertips that we're literally giving away, I can't not do it. And in some days, it's almost impossible just to get out of bed. I will miss my 7-year-old son, Daniel, for the rest of my life. He will always be my little 7-year-old Daniel. He should be turning 14 at the end of this week on the 27th. But I find it such a appropriate way to honor my sweet little boy is by bringing this to students across the country.
So what's working in the program? When you talk to students, what's coming back to you that is making the Sandy Hook Promise thing that's actually effective?
We are seeing it work in so many different ways, and we're actually studying this to learn more about it, but we are growing a base of anecdotes from the field of students who are empowered with our programs. Let's start with the Hello program, the Say Something program, who are literally intervening on tragedies before they happen. We've literally stopped school shootings, and there are little towns across this country that we won't know the names of because they're not associated with a horrible tragedy because it didn't happen because students followed our model. We are intervening on suicides, mass casualty events, bullying, cutting, eating disorders, you name it. The simple premises of the Start with a Low program trains kids how to connect with students who are socially isolated, make them feel validated and visible. And the Say Something program trains kids to look for at-risk language and behavior either at school or at home or in social media, and then connect that individual with a trusted adult either by way of conversation or by using our anonymous reporting system. We have built more connected schools, fostered a more connected communities, prevented tragedies from happening from kids using our free programs.
So both here in the Berkshires and beyond, what kind of like community partners are the most effective in carrying out this mission?
So we have incredible partnership with the Attorney General's office here in Massachusetts. Maura Healey and her crew have really stepped in, leaned in big time with Sandy Hook Promise and bringing these programs throughout the state. They have applied for and won the Stop School Violence Act grant that allows us to offset our costs. And then right here in North Adams, we're seeing elected officials, school administration, and the greater community all really invest in this and invest in their students in a wonderfully powerful way. And it's coming back from the students. They are so engaged in this, and they are so eager and inspired to take this work back into their school and back out into the community, and we're watching it spread from there. And we're seeing that across the state of Massachusetts as well with other districts. I think we're at 45 districts now who are training on Start With Hello and Say Something. So it's incredible to watch Massachusetts emerge as a model and a leader in this for other states to look at.
This morning at Drury High School, did anything you heard from the students really resonate with you?
You know, I'll have to tell you, I'm still processing what I heard from the students here in our roundtable discussion with them, because every single one of them had something very important and profound to share. And some of them dug so deep into their heart and soul and shared very personal information and stories and anecdotes. And they obviously felt safe here to be vulnerable. And I'm thinking through some of the things that I heard from these students that I'm going to take back to our team, and we're going to incorporate that into how we make this model better. And beyond that, I want to share it with my family. Some of the stories that I heard today were just so inspiring. I will think about this always.
Mark Barden is the co-founder of Sandy Hook Promise, a nonprofit that offers help with violence prevention and mental health training programs. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Josh Landes. Mr. Barden is not alone. In some U.S. cities, officials are taking a fresh look at gun violence and treating it as a public health issue. That means examining how it can lead to anxiety, stress, and other mental health issues. Christine Herman from Side Effects Public Media reports on a new effort in Illinois that aims to help people recover from a traumatic experience.
Yvonne Johnson lost her son, David Sankey, last August. He was 16.
That was my baby. That's all I had. And somebody decided to come on his block and fire a gun. Not one time, six shots. One kid hit mine.
Sankey was one of the eight people who died from gun violence last year in Champaign-Urbana, home of the University of Illinois. More than 100 others were shot and survived. Sankey's grandmother, Legatrice Benton Miniweather, says losing him is the most painful thing she's ever experienced.
I've been around David ever since he was born. It wasn't hardly a day I didn't see him. I loved him so much. He loved me so much. And at the time this happened, I didn't know what to do. I was just lost.
So lost, she considered taking her own life.
I feel like somebody just snatched my heart out of my body. I don't feel I would ever recover from this.
Sankey's relatives spoke recently to a group at Jericho Missionary Baptist Church. They said the support of community and church members was vital to them making it through. The meeting was the area's first violence response forum. Police, schools, and government officials came together to provide support and other resources following a violent incident. In this case, a shooting that took place just blocks from the church. One person was injured, and another, Elijah Booker, was killed. He was 14.
We are here to let you know that you are not alone.
Patricia Avery is part of the local violence response team.
We know that there are people out there that are trying to cope and understand what is going on. There is too much violence, there is too much pain, there's too much suffering, and so we as a community have to stand together.
All across the U.S., cities are stepping up to address the impact of violence. In the Midwest, Cleveland and Chicago have launched programs like the one in Champaign. And the Indianapolis City Council has formally declared gun violence a public health issue. University of Maryland epidemiologist Wendy Lane says these initiatives can really help. She studies the effects of trauma on women who live in one of Baltimore's most violent areas.
Their stress levels are incredibly high, and they feel that anxiety. from being constantly exposed to traumatic events.
That exposure can lead to long-term anxiety and depression. Lane says efforts to wrap support around people after violent incidents can help prevent some of those problems, with one caveat.
Just coming in right after it happens isn't going to be the only solution. There has to be ongoing services.
And she says those services need to reach the people who need them most. But to really address community violence, Lane says cities must address root causes, like poverty. At the Violence Response Forum in Champaign, Police Chief Anthony Cobb echoed that sentiment.
And the root causes, how we're going to help our young people. How do we invest in them? How we help them to feel good so they're not as apathetic and they don't want to go down these paths? How we make those paths look less inviting to them? That's where the community is going to come together at. And so that's how we got to resolve that issue.
Organizers say they'll continue to refine the violence response program based on the advice of residents. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
There is now a database of over 50 years of mass shootings to try and find patterns that may prevent future massacres. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do we reduce mass shootings? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jillian Peterson, assistant professor of criminal justice at Hamline University, looks into the data.
The Mass Shooter Database seeks to answer the how and why of mass shootings using data-driven research. With that knowledge, prevention might be possible. We have built a database of 160 public mass shootings with four more victims, beginning with the 1966 mass shooting at the University of Texas, Austin. Using public records, Hamline students have coded each incident for psychosocial variables such as family structure, education and employment history, past trauma, mental illness, social media profiles, and type of gun used. The emerging patterns could be useful in developing prevention strategies, especially K-12 school and university settings. For example, the data show that all of K-12 school shooters were male between the ages of 12 and 17. The majority were white, and nearly all, 91%, were students or former students at the targeted school. University shooters tended to be non-white, 50% were Asian, and 33% were mixed race. All but one was a current or former student at the university. Both university and K-12 shooters had risk factors for violence, such as childhood trauma. All university perpetrators and 77% of K-12 shooters had documented mental health concerns. 87% of K-12 mass shooters and all university shooters showed signs of a crisis before the shooting. A great majority of both groups were suicidal. These findings suggest that supportive strategies focused on the history of trauma, mental health concerns, and suicidality might be able to reduce the risk of mass shootings in educational settings. We still have much to learn. Currently, the team is creating a database of community-level risk factors and interviewing living mass shooters.
That was Jillian Peterson of Hamline University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.